Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of noon lectures sponsored by the Associated Student Speakers Program. Today, directly following the speech, there will be a question and answer period. There are two floor mics set up on either side of the room. If you'd like to ask a question, if you can find the mic, glad to take them all. Today we are privileged to have with us a public servant who's been serving America for all of his adult life. At the present time, he's a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota and at McAllister College. He continues as a member of the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian Institution and was recently elected to the Board of Trustees at Brandeis University. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the former Vice President of the United States, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Richard Marks, and my special thanks to Janie Robbins that came down to greet us, and I lost her. Oh, there she is, right over here. And Janie, you ought to stand up. You're the best that they're going to have here today. And I do want to thank the UCLA Associated Student Speakers Program for including me in on this occasion. I asked Richard what he expected from me, and he said, "More than you're going to give." I didn't expect that was the answer that I would receive. And I said, "Do you want this strictly informal question and answer?" And he said, "Well, we would like to have you sort of hold forth for a while and whatever you'd like to talk about. Then from there on out, we'll have the questions." And that's the way I'd like it. Now, I have returned to the classroom, not voluntarily, but I have returned. Some 25 years ago, I was a professor of government, and then I decided that I would like to practice some of what I had been teaching, and I think that's what got me in trouble. But I have felt, since having been in government for some 24 years, that all that I once taught in the courses in American government, I should say all the students that I taught, were entitled to a refund. Because compared to what was written and what I taught and what happens and what I've seen, well, it just doesn't match. That's all. I came to college campuses many times in my 16 years in the Senate and 4 years in the Vice Presidency. And when I was Vice President in particular, I would say something like this, that I'm a refugee from a classroom. And people would say, "Well, that's good. That's one of the things that helps education." And then I would I'd look around and I jokingly would say, "I want the president of the university, if he was available, if he could get out of a building or get in it, if he was around, I would say I'd like to have him know that my credentials are in good order. I'd look for the member of the Board of Regents or trustees and tell them that I tried to keep up to date." And I said, "You know how public life is, particularly elected public life. It's so precarious and so uncertain." And then I would chuckle a bit, thinking that was all a joke. I never realized how persuasive I turned out to be. I've made the complete circuit. And here I am back again as a visiting professor to my own home university, to a very fine private college, a member of a board of trustees of one of the most exciting and creative universities in America, and still actively engaged in the work of education at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, of which I am privileged to serve as chairman. I want to talk to you today about some of our domestic concerns. I know that tomorrow, or very shortly, that you will have a very distinguished man here, Dr. Ralph Bunch, who will undoubtedly be able to enlighten you on many matters of international concern. But this story, this meeting is open for all forms of questions. I did not come here to recruit Lou Alcindor. I want you to know that before we start. Even though I've had one or two whisper to me that if I could make any contact, it would be worth my time. But I've decided to teach, not to be a broker. So I'm going to try to do a little of that today. I asked Richard and Janie on the way to this meeting about some of the activities of UCLA, because every great university has a host of activities that are all too seldom reported or known by an interested public. I know, for example, of your UniCamp for your disadvantaged and handicapped in this community. I wish more people in America knew that about UCLA. I wish they knew that it was primarily financed out of the student activity, out of your Mardi Gras and other programs. I wish they heard that part of student life. I wish that more of our fellow Americans knew about the tutorial work that goes on voluntarily from thousands and indeed many thousands of gifted and talented university students. I wish that the word of the Venice Project would get a little bit further east than just the boundaries of the state of California. I wish that people who are so concerned these days and critical would know of your high potential program for particularly students in minority groups that have high potential and through no fault of their own have been denied a chance to be fully and prepared under the terms of orthodox university regulations and standards for a university career. This is a part of the student action that isn't reported. I also think that it's time that the American educational community, those responsible for it, recognize that there is a desperate need and a critical need for a reevaluation of many of the campus rules, much of the administrative structure, and the relationship between administration, faculty, and student. I have very personal views about this. I've never seen any reason at all why it required disturbance to get programs of Afro-American studies. I would have thought that those of us that are educators or claim to be would have been out in front on that a decade ago. Indeed, we should have been. I think that we ought to recognize by now that in the non-academic areas of college life, that students must have a very prominent role, if not the controlling role, in their rules and regulations. Otherwise, these rules will not be abided by. I think we also ought to recognize that there is a deep concern amongst many students who expected to get some good teaching, that they'd see their teachers and that they'd see their professors. Now, I'm not going to spend much of my time in the next few years on research. I'll let you in on a secret. There are warehouses full of research. And I happen to believe that research is needed and it must be continuing. I am a person that believes in basic research in the field of sciences. I believe in research in the field of the humanities, of social science. But I do not believe in research for research's sake. I believe that a university is what was once described in Greek literature, Socrates on one end of a log and a student on the other. It's the dialogue between teacher and student. It's a feeling of community and of the ability to communicate. Everybody likes to talk these days about the generation gap. Well, as one who's been around a bit, I've seen some young men and women at age 18 or 20 that were already, that is, in terms of their attitude, ready for Social Security and Medicare. I found some like that. I found a few at the ages of 65, 70, and 75 that were ready for a piece of the action. So I think that one can say that it isn't so much a generation gap as it is possibly a communications gap. And we're all so busy. We're all so big. Institutions are so big. Government is so big. Universities are so big. Business is so big. Everything is so big and computerized that we have lost some of the human element, which is vital to the educational process. So I intend in the few months that I may be privileged to teach, or years, to try to spend my time making teaching popular and making teaching not just research and writing, but making teaching what it ought to be, communication, where the professor may learn more than he teaches and where the student may feel a sense of rapport with the man that is on the other side of the desk, so to speak, or on the other end of the log. Now, why is it that we have a great deal of concern running through our campuses and all through our community? There are many reasons, and you can pick individual incidents, you can pick a particular event and say that's it, that's what triggers it. But let's just take a look at the kind of a society in which we live. It's many ways a great and magnificent social structure. In many ways, it's a great and unbelievably successful economic structure. In many ways, it's the best that man has been able to create in terms of a political structure. But in many ways, it isn't. And to a sensitive people, it's the gaps, it's the weaknesses, the limitations that caused concern and finally cause trouble, unless those limitations and weaknesses and injustices are corrected. Now, I'm talking to an audience that is generally described as the now generation. Get it done now. Well, much of what we need to do can be done now. Some things can't. And I happen to believe that frank and straight talk to the best of one's ability, with the limitations of his background and knowledge, is the best way to communicate. It isn't really important that a professor be popular. It is important that he speak his mind and that the student have the same privilege. That there be an exchange of thought on the basis of intellectual integrity, and that there be communication and not just words. Here we see a situation, hunger in this country, and real hunger, not just malnutrition, but people going hungry in a society that for over 30 years has been complaining about food surpluses. And thank God, at long last, there's an interest in the American public, and particularly amongst young people and amongst others, to see that something can be done about it. Now, this is a problem that can be answered now. If you put yourself to this one, we can get it done now. In this Congress, in this year, in this administration, in this country, so that by the year 1970, not a single man, woman, or child in America is without an adequate diet. Now that's something for the now generation. And we can do that. And I hope that you'll bend your efforts to it and study it carefully. May I just give young people a word of advice? When you run up against establishment, be careful that you have your facts right, because frequently the leader of the establishment, as they put it, will find you on some miscalculation of minor significance, and that'll become the whole frame of argument. So be sure of your information. And you don't need to worry. There's plenty of information that you can be sure of, and if you're doubtful, cast it aside, because you'll have a big enough case with what is positive, certain, sure, and sound. So the hunger in the midst of plenty, it's politically dangerous, it's economically indefensible, and it's morally wrong. All of which I think makes a pretty good case for doing something about it. It costs something, yes, but not much, in this fantastic budget of ours and this economy that's approaching the $1 trillion figure. It is said that for less than $1 billion, we can see to it that not a single man, woman, or child in this country goes without an adequate, balanced diet. Well, that's something that we can do. Unemployment. Now, this is a little more difficult. In the greatest industrial boom that the nation has ever known, what kind of unemployment? Hardcore unemployment. Why? Because many of the people that today are without jobs have never had training for the job. They've have no industrial orientation. They are like foreigners in a strange country. Whose fault? Theirs? Obviously not. Separate but equal? Never was. It was separate and unequal all the time. And you and I know it. Now, when I hear people say to me, for example, well, we got to give everybody an equal opportunity now, I say, well, you're going to lose that game right now. People who have been denied for a century must have more than equal opportunity. They must have an extra dose of opportunity. And we're going to have the patience and the perseverance and the creativity to find ways and means of inspiring motivation, of bringing skills or semi-skills to people who have none, and of following through. We bring in this great nation of ours, if a person comes in from Cuba, and they're surely welcome, the government of the United States tries to be of some help in orienting that person to a new environment and follow through for a job. Well, what about a fellow American that may come from Alabama or Mississippi or South Carolina or Minnesota or California that is without skills, without a good education, without a cultural background that equips him for life in the great urban centers? Are we to ignore them and say, well, individualism, freedom of choice, the choice being what? More of the same, only worse. Poverty. 10 years ago, if a speaker came to this campus and talked about poverty in the United States, the student body and the faculty, with few exceptions, would look at him and say, what's he talking about? Oh, sure, there are a few poor people around, we know that, but mainly because they don't want to work. That's what they used to say. And then finally, some of the great spiritual leaders in this country and social leaders in America, people in the academic life and in the fields of social work and the humanities, found that poverty was not just an occasional blight, but it was here, indigenous, cancerous, malignant, in substantial measure. And while it is true that we haven't done nearly what we need to about it, we have recognized the problem as a nation in public policy for the first time, not merely to see to it that the poor had something to eat, which is still a matter to be fulfilled in many instances, but that we recognize poverty in all of its dimensions and tried to do something constructive to eradicate it. Poverty in the midst of untold wealth, that's why it's so blatantly wrong. That's why people rebel. That's why there is such deep tension and frustration. Because you and I know it doesn't need to be. There may have been a time that people could be poor because there wasn't any way to correct it. But believe me, that's not the case today. Now, we don't know all of the answers, and I appeal to this student body to be understanding. I appeal to you to be innovative, creative, experimental. We do not know how to cure cancer of the body. But we do not throw out every scientist and doctor that fails in an experiment. We say, try it again, doctor. Go at it again, Mr. Technician. Here's another grant of funds. Follow this idea. Follow this particular approach. And for better than 50 years, the medical profession of this land has been searching relentlessly for an answer to cancer in all of its forms. And we've made some progress. And we hail every progress and we say it's great good news. Well, there's another kind of cancer of the human spirit called poverty. And for thousands of years, we have looked at it as if it were like leprosy and isolated the poor. And now at long last, we say maybe we can treat it. Maybe we can find an answer. And we experiment. And when we experiment with public funds and some of it's wasted, immediately there is an investigation. And then somebody says it's boondoggling, and somebody says it's corruption. When we ask the poor to help manage their own affairs, when they've never had a chance in their lives to manage anything and they make a mistake, we say abolish the community action programs. Ladies and gentlemen, the way to develop a mature individual is to give him the responsibilities of maturity. And many of the poor and the deprived in this country and the disadvantaged have been denied any chance to have responsibility for their lives. They've had no chance to have anything to say about their decisions that affect their lives. And if in the next decade, as we try to give them that opportunity to make decisions affecting their lives, they make some mistakes, Be as tolerant of them, will you, as you are of the doctor that has gained fame and a Nobel Prize, who may have spent 25 to 30 years making one mistake after another until he found the answer. Just be that tolerant, and you're going to have to take a stand. Because just as surely as I'm looking at you now, there will be a wave, a move in this country to try to turn back on some of these programs. I don't say they're all good, some should be discarded. But I say when we succeed in one endeavor, we should build from it, and we must be willing to innovate. And here we live at the time of urban life. What is the characteristic of modern society? Urbanization, for which we're poorly prepared physically, emotionally, intellectually, and economically. Urbanization, the vast movement of people, not only in America, but all over the world, to the cities, from the mountains, the Andes, into Lima, into Santiago, Chile, into Rio, into city after city, from the fields of India into Calcutta, and from America that was only 50 years ago essentially a rural society into a nation today that has 70% of its population on 2% of its land, and which in the next few years, in the next 25 years, will double that population. And we'll need to find 19 million more acres of land for urban development. Magnificent cities with libraries and museums and commercial structures and stadium and orchestras and factories and parks and streets. Magnificent cities. A city in which you can build a magnificent new commercial building, an office building of 50, 100 stories high, and within its shadow the filth of humanity. We know how to build. The magnificence of the city with the filth and the ugliness of the ghetto. Is it any wonder that people are bewildered? Is it any wonder that there's a sense of frustration? Now, I suggest that we turn that frustration and bewilderment into constructive purpose. I suggest that we start to make the kind of a commitment that this country needs. And I've suggested it for a long time in reference to our cities. I've said we needed to do for the American city, which in many ways is as demolished as the city of Western Europe after World War II, that we needed a Marshall Plan for our cities. And what do I mean by that? A long-term commitment, adequate sums of money, planning, cooperation between the donor and the receiver, and considering human values as well as physical structure. Don't tell me we can't do it. We can build 45,000 miles of interstate highway in this country at the cost of millions of dollars per mile, and we can build it on schedule. We can build commercial recreation facilities. We can put the Apollo 8 and the Apollo 9 ahead of schedule. The most intricate type of design and engineering and technology that the world has ever known. We can create a beautiful, perfect environment for man to go to the moon. But we can't do it in Los Angeles. Isn't that amazing? And in our society, it isn't a question of either or. It's a question of doing it together. Many times I have indicated to some of you and others that a society or a nation that can put a man on the moon and pay for it and do it ought to be able to help and be willing to put a man on his feet right here on Earth to do it and to pay for it. We can do it. Now, what are some of the dimensions of this problem? People like to talk about the urban crisis. Well, what do you mean by crisis? You know, the trouble of this day and age is we use adjectives so generously that you hardly know which one means anything anymore. You see somebody, you say, you're beautiful, when you know darn well they're not. And you see somebody and you say, well, I hope you're feeling well, when you really haven't got feeling at all. We say a lot of things. It's a pattern that today, and we have the extravagant language, and I'm as guilty of it as everybody else. Crisis. What is it? I figured I'd get a response out of that. All of you Republicans that have to go to class, well, you can go in after a while. But I want all the dissident Democrats to stay because we're trying to patch up things now, you know? You ever thought about who's president when Mr. Nixon's out of town? This is what used to worry the country when President Johnson left and I was around. Why, when you're vice president, you live for those moments. I'm always being deflected here, but I read where Professor Goldman had something to say about abolishing the office of the vice president. I hope that we'll get around to that in the question period because I want to take him on here. After all, it's a good place to do it. Well, what about this? What do we mean by crisis? Let's define it. I'll tell you what we mean by crisis. The worst schools, the poorest schools, and the areas that need them the most, that need the best schools. The poorest education in the areas where the people need the best education. That's crisis. And that is a fact in all too many cities across America. Secondly, the fewest number of garbage collections in the area where there's the most garbage because there's the most people who need sanitation protection. That's crisis. The high rates of crime in areas where police are needed more often and better police and there are fewer of them and lower grade police. Unemployment and low income or sub-unemployment or sub-employment amongst the blacks, the Mexican-American, the Puerto Rican, and other minority groups. Employment where unemployment where employment is needed. Pollution. The pollution of water. The pollution of air, which has no respect for ethnic group, income, or area. That's crisis. Housing. And let's just lay it on the line. There is no way to correct the ills of the modern city until you give people decent housing and provide decent housing for them in which to live. And that is a man, that's a must. Let me give you an example. The late Senator Robert Taft, who was no revolutionary, in cooperation with Senator Allen Ellender of Louisiana, who isn't any revolutionary, were the authors of the Housing Act of 1949. And they said in that act that every American is entitled to a decent home, to decent housing. They prescribed in that act, 1949, that we would build 135,000 units of low-income, low-rent public housing every year for 6 years, 810,000 units. That was 1949. 20 years have gone by. And in the 20 years, we've built less than 500,000 units. When it was required in the Act of 49, before this urban crisis was so visible, that we would build 810,000 units in 6 years. Why? I'll tell you why. Because legislators listen to public opinion. Because legislators were convinced that low income, low rent, public housing was not wanted. So that today the poor people of America are more poorly housed now than they were 10 years ago. And you want something to act on? I'm going to make a suggestion. I'd like to help save the world too. But frankly, it's a big job. I've worked at it a little bit, and I'm not weary. I do become a little concerned as to whether I'll live long enough to make it. But I'll tell you one place to start saving it. Right here. In this university, in this city, in this county, where you can look at what you're doing, see what you're doing, see whether what you're doing is effective. The best foreign policy is a working, effective domestic policy. And you're not going to abolish poverty in the world until you make some inroads on it right here in the United States of America. Of course, that isn't quite so dramatic as some of these other things. I know that. You can be such an expert on some parts of the world that you've never visited. So easy. but try to be informed on the part of the world where you live. And the sum total of the parts makes the whole. And finally, the issue of race tells us what the crisis is. And America is a unique country in this. We're multiracial, not just biracial. And we are right at the point in our history where we're going to determine whether or not this will be an integrated society, and I don't mean a non-segregated, I mean an integrated society, in which we recognize that there is one race called the human race, or whether or not we're going to be the society that the Kerner Report spoke about, separate and unequal, whether or not we're going to have American apartheid, whether we're going to have separatism here, or whether we're going to learn to live as a community. And may I say that the problem of the city focuses attention upon it all, because the neglect of the city today is an example of the neglect of the minorities, because more and more of the blacks, the Puerto Ricans, the Mexican Americans, the Indians and others have moved to our inner cities. And when I see my white brethren go to the suburbs and ring the center city with a white band and see the city services of the inner city and the center city die because of lack of revenue and even sometimes lack of talent, I say that's the worst form of discrimination. And all the pronouncements and all the brotherhood campaigns put together cannot erase it. There's only one way to meet the problems of this country that are tied up in what we call race. And that's to start to treat people like people. I heard an old minister say, and I know this isn't very fashionable these days, but so be it. Everybody has his right to have his own idea of his own faith. And he said, the way you treat people is the way you treat God. And I suggest that the greatest contribution that the American student can make to the world is to talk about people. P-E-O-P-L-E or P-E-E-P-U-L, if you want it that way. Just people. How do we think about them? Not black people, not white people, not brown people, not red people, but people. And start to recognize that the great resources of this country, the great potential of this country, is yet to be discovered in those people. Well, now they say, well, what are you going to do about all this stuff? That's a great idea, Humphrey. What are you going to do about it? Well, first thing you got to know is, what's the problem? I think we've made enough studies. I don't think we've taken them seriously. That's the problem. That's number one. Well, we've done something. We've made some advances. We ought not to minimize them. The breakthroughs, the beginnings, are very important. Model cities, which for the first time coordinates all of the many governmental programs for both physical and human rehabilitation, puts a premium upon community planning, puts a premium upon local action. The Housing Act, which is the most far-reaching housing program, the Act of 1968, good, but it has yet to be implemented. We've just put down the cornerstone. Question is whether you're ever going to build any housing under it. It pledges 6 million low-income housing units in the next 10 years, not 810,000, but 6 million. Let's see whether we get at it. Let's see whether the bond issues will be voted. Let's see whether or not the taxes will be collected. There are some other things that are needed. An urban development bank. You can't finance the American city with conventional financing any more than you could have financed the opening of the West without the Federal Land Bank, any more than you could have financed the development of REA without the Rural Electrification Bank and Administration. It took governmental action in cooperation with private resources. And until we start to find the money, as one mayor said not long ago, they said, what are the problems of the city? He said, there are three: money, income, and revenues. Cities today are bankrupt, literally bankrupt, unable to sell their bonds, unable to provide their services. And here we sit with an obsolete governmental structure, federal, state, and local, that is unable to come to grips with the many conflicting problems of the metropolitan life and the metropolitan area. Take a look at your own area here. Take a look at any other area, the multiplicity of governmental jurisdictions. If you happen to get the county to agree to a plan, then the city doesn't like it. If you get the city to agree to it, then there's a special jurisdiction like the Port Authority that doesn't like it. If you get the Port Authority on, then the state doesn't like it. And you have one constant set of problems. What do you have to do? Well, we've got a lot of talk about model cities. I suggest model states. First of all, model states. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, let's revise state constitutions. Let's give them the authority to the cities and to the metropolitan areas that are required to raise the funds to do the planning, to provide the services. There isn't a city in America that has any authority on its own. It gains all of it from its legislature of its state. The child of the state is the city. The city is the child of the state. It has only that which it is granted by legislative act, by constitutional authority or charter. And all this talk about modernization of the American city must start at the state capital and the federal level. And when we start to put the two major partners to working together, state and federal, or federal and state, and then authorize the, give the authority for municipal and development on new jurisdictions, new legal authorities, we'll begin to get something done. The cost of land is prohibitive for low-income housing. We need an Urban Homestead Act. How did you open America? You have a Homestead Act for rural America. That's the way many of your grandparents got their start. An Urban Homestead Act to subsidize the high cost of land values so that we can find decent housing for low and middle-income groups to take care of their needs and the public services that are required in parks and cultural centers. How do we pay for it? Well, first of all, the growth of the economy, what I call the growth dividend. It will run for the next 2 to 3 years at the rate over and above all contemplated expenditures that we could set aside $2 to $3 billion in 19 fiscal 70 and 71. By fiscal 72, it could be as high as $30 billion. And that's the kind of an injection of finance that is needed, a massive national commitment. The peace dividend, to bring this war to an end, and to bring this war to an end, to put these resources as quickly as possible into the building and the rebuilding of our urban life, to re-examine and take an inventory of every commitment that this nation has abroad, not to withdraw from the world, but to quit thinking that it's our plum, our pie, our lake. Now I want to leave you with a little story about, I know many of you are deeply concerned about the inadequacy of our whole structure. Remember what Winston Churchill, I got two Churchillian stories, they're always, he, with all of his limitations, he really did get on target many times. Churchill once in a debate in the House of Commons was challenged on forms of government, and he said, democracy is the worst possible form of government ever tried. The worst possible form of government, except all others that have been ever tried. And I think that when we think about what we have done and what we need to do, that we could be reminded of that sweet little leader of the temperance movement in Britain who called upon the Prime Minister during the war years. And she and her group were deeply concerned about the consumption of alcoholic beverages by Sir Winston. He was noted for having consumed rather copious quantities of it. And they had a little meeting of their group, and they made an evaluation or an estimate of the volume that he had consumed. And they appointed this dear, sweet little old lady in tennis shoes to come and meet with the Prime Minister, and she came in and he granted her an audience. And she said, Mr. Prime Minister, I'm here to represent the temperance movement. And we know that you drink large, copious quantities of whiskey and brandy and other alcoholic beverages, and we think it's deplorable. We have estimated the amount that you have consumed, and we have the dimensions of your office. And we have estimated that if all the alcoholic beverage that you've consumed since you were prime minister were to be poured into this office, it would come up to about here. And Sir Winston looked at this sweet little old lady and he said, "Is that all you have to say?" And she said, "Yes, what do you have to say?" He looked at where her hand was. He looked to the floor. He looked to the ceiling. He said, "So little have I done. So much is there yet to do." Thank you very much.
Thank you. I know many of you have 1 o'clock classes, so we'll just take a minute for you to exit through the crowd. There are seats, a few of them up in the front. Those who would like to stay for the question and answers, possibly you could come up and take them. If not, we're just going to wait a few minutes and then commence with the questions. We're going to alternate mics, and if please, you could just ask one question and wait for the answer.